I don't know what women talk about amongst themselves because I'm not a woman. But I know when men get together and they talk about, you know, with other men, they'll say things like, well, what do you do for a living? And that's just a common thing. And, of course, the likely response is some kind of job or some kind of career or enterprise, special skill. What if someone were to say, when asked, what do you do for a living? And they said, I'm a disciple of Jesus Christ. Well, that would raise some eyebrows, wouldn't it? And I'm not suggesting that you have to go do that. I'm just simply saying, for the point of illustration, what if that were the response? It's not uncommon for Christians today, and I'm going to use Christians in even the loosest sense of the word, people who call themselves Christians when the doctrine is questionable and so on. It is not uncommon for Christians today to say something like, I go to church, or I go to this church, or I go to that congregation, or those in denominational circles will say something like, I go to insert denomination. Presbyterian Church, Catholic Church, you know, Methodist Church, whatever it might be. You might see I don't know how you could miss it anymore, on the buses, the I Am a Mormon campaign. And I'm thinking about that. I'm thinking, they're identifying really with a religion. They're identifying with a denomination. What if they were to just simply put on the billboard, I am a Christian? Wouldn't that be more accurate? I mean, true to the Bible, that is, if you're trying to be biblical and, you know, true to what you believe in, why not just say, I'm a Christian? Why does there have to be a name? Why does there have to be another man-made name attached to that? In other words, we may identify ourselves with a particular religion, but not necessarily with Christ, and this is a problem. The extension of this problem is that we don't see what I just said as a problem. We're comfortable with it. When I say we, I'm being very general in my statement. I'm not saying you all necessarily, but just we people, we get comfortable with that. Someone says, where do you go on Sunday? We say, I go to this and that church. Instead of really getting to the core of this. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 12, Paul said in hearing rumors about what's going on there in Corinth, he says, now I mean this, that each of one of you is saying, I am of Paul, and I am of Apollos, and I of Cephas, and I of Christ. Has Christ been divided? Now, when he says there that some of you are saying, I am of Christ, that's not a wrong statement. He's not saying that you shouldn't have said that. What he's actually saying is that some of you have it right and some of you have it wrong. And those people of you who are saying, I'm of Paul or Cephas, you have it wrong. Those of you who are saying, I'm of Christ, that's exactly correct. But what he's simply saying here is that you're all divided. And Christ is not divided. That's the rhetorical question. Has Christ been divided? So he's not criticizing that aspect of it. When we say, I'm a disciple of Jesus Christ, we're making a direct connection between the master and his student. There's no question, then, who we belong to. That's why I'm purposely using the word disciple for this series instead of Christian, because the word Christian has been so watered down and misused and abused and kicked around and everything else that nobody really knows what we mean anymore when we say Christian. Christian has a very loose connotation in our modern vernacular, but disciple has remained the same. Disciple is what it is. It is a definition. It's not just an appeal to a Christian religion. It is a definition. If I am a disciple of the master, then I'm the pupil. He's the teacher, which is what we talked about last night. And there can be no gray area there. Throughout the book of Acts, in fact, the Christians are referred to and refer to one another as disciples. That is the most often used descriptor of the believers there. You never hear someone say in the book of Acts, well, I'm a member of the church of Ephesus, or I go to the Ephesian church of Christ, or I belong to this sect or denomination, and fill in the blank. You never hear that, and that should be conspicuous to you, because the emphasis was not on what are you as a brand name, but rather what do you do with your life? That's what I wanted to bring forward to you tonight. What do you do with your life? What is your career? What is your vocation, as we'll talk about in just a moment? The connection of the early disciples was with Christ. What they're saying is, he is my master and I am his disciple. It's not a mere religious affiliation. It's a personal commitment and a personal devotion. In reality, it most certainly is a vocation. And that begs the question, well, what is a vocation? I'm glad you asked that, because that's my next slide, okay? And it just segues right into that there, okay? So religion often describes standardized communal devotion to something, okay? A collective adherence to an organized code of beliefs and practices, like the Christian religion, or the Muslim religion, or Hinduism, or Judaism, or any one of those other isms that are out there, and there's a whole bunch of them. In another sense, it can be completely unstandardized or unorganized, like someone saying, I got religion. Well, he's not really appealing to much of anything, except, a feeling there, no real tapping into anything other than something spiritual, right? And yet it remains very subjective. It's just an emotional experience that he's had, some kind of internal euphoria. By the way, I should say something like, that on that, when we talk about spiritual, we're not necessarily talking about godliness. You know that Satanists are very spiritual people. So are witches and warlocks. They're all very spiritual people, because they dabble in spirituality. So when we say spiritual, sometimes we think, oh, you mean Christian. Not necessarily. Not unless it's used in the right context. So let's at least understand this. Religion by itself does not make a direct connection between the thing or entity being followed and the one who follows that thing or entity. It's just someone belonging to a spiritual movement. Something that they have chosen to follow, like a cause in some cases. Vocation is much more specific, and that's really what I want to get to. And it actually comes to us from a Latin word from the 15th century, and it literally means a calling. And so when we're looking at vocation, we're really looking at a calling, specifically as those who first use the word, God's calling of someone into service. So there's a calling on God's part, inviting someone into service with him, and then that person responding to that call. That is the implication. And that brings to mind a couple of passages that we just can consider quickly here. In Isaiah chapter 6, verse 8, for example, it says, "Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send, and who will go for us? And I said, here I am, send me." God did not say, we need someone to start a religion. And he didn't say, we need someone to be spiritual or to get spiritual. And he didn't say, we need someone to build a church. What he did say, in essence, was, we need someone to carry out my will as a servant. There is Isaiah's vocation, his calling. And Isaiah responded most appropriately, here I am, send me. In Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 4 through 5 there, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. And before you were born, I consecrated you. I have appointed you a prophet to the nations. God didn't say to Jeremiah, I need you to get religion or to start a religious movement, but I need you to follow after me as my servant. What I say, I need you to say. What I instruct, I need you to do. God called Jeremiah in that respect. In Matthew chapter 9 and verse 9, as Jesus went on from there, it says, he saw a man called Matthew, otherwise known as Levi, sitting in the tax collector's booth, and he said to him, follow me. And he got up and followed him. I find that amazing. That Jesus is walking by. Imagine this is a tax booth, and Matthew's sitting there, and Jesus just walks by and says, follow me. And Matthew just gets up, leaves the booth, and follows him. That is remarkable. Partly because you just don't see that kind of commitment today. Because people today sit back and go, well, what's in it for me? Or they say, well, what do you mean by that? Follow you. Exactly. Like Jesus said in Luke chapter 9, verse 57 through 62, where he's saying, follow me to others. And they say, well, let me go back and tell the parents. Or let me go and bury my father. Or let me go take care of something else first. Matthew gets up and follows him. That was his calling. Jesus did not say to him, I need you to go to church. He did not say to him, identify yourself with this synagogue or that synagogue or to follow this particular spiritual movement. Well, what he said is, follow me. And what that translates to is, become my disciple and let me be your teacher. And look how he responded. He got up and followed him. Matthew chapter 19, verse 21. This is the rich man, the young rich ruler, we often refer to him as, who Jesus said to him, if you wish to be complete, go and sell your possessions and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, and come follow me. And in this case, the man did not follow him. But Jesus did not say to him, I need you to feel more spiritual, or I need you to join a church. I need you to get involved in organized religion. He simply said, follow me and leave behind everything that prevents you from following me. And the man would not do it. So we see two different cases. One where he gets up and leaves everything behind, and another where he's sitting there counting all the things that he's going to lose by following him and then not following. This calling or this vocation is not a summons to seek membership in a congregation, which sadly is the primary goal of so many Christians today. If they find themselves in a particular congregation and they get on the directory and they're given a job or two to do, in their mind, in many cases, that's Christianity. That's it. That's what it's all about as far as their religious service to God. And you know as well as I do, there's so much more than that. What God means when he calls us is transforming us little by little, day by day, but steadily and gradually into a follower of Christ, being more and more conformed to the Master. So then we have, in essence, a typical human-like perception where, hey, I'm in a church. People should be happy, right? I'm in a church and I go faithfully every Sunday and even the classes and even special stuff like this, right? And then on the other hand, God's perspective where he says, I need you to commit to me on a daily basis to come closer and closer to who my son is. Those two things are not equal. They're not comparable. They are not on the same plane. And they do not achieve the same objective. Today, one's vocation, the word vocation, is often referring to one's job or career path. In essence, God has been taken out of the picture altogether from what it used to mean. When God or Jesus called people, they did not say to them, I need you to change jobs or switch careers. What he said to them, in essence, is I need you to give yourself over to my work, to submit entirely to my oversight. The lesson's not done. But the question for you is that what you did? Or if you didn't do that exactly, is that what you're planning to do now? That's the question I want you to think about through the rest of the lesson as we continue. Not surprisingly, Christians collectively are a called people. You'll find that over and over in the New Testament. In fact, the very word ecclesia, from which we get church, literally means called out, or a called out group, or a people called out of something, or just simply the called out. And so the idea of being called or being called out or being called into fellowship is something that is not foreign to us if we're studying the New Testament. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9, Peter says, you were a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of what? Of who? Of him who has called you out of darkness and into his marvelous light. That's something that you should pick up on real quick here, is anytime God calls you, he's calling you out of one thing and into another. He never calls you into limbo. He never calls you out of something and not into something. And in order for him to call you into something, it means you have to leave something else behind. That's the nature of discipleship. That's what it's all about. So Christians are not called to attend church services or to go to classes or to go to Bible studies. And again, I'm not saying these things are wrong or that we should stop doing them. They have their place and we should do them. But that's not what we're called to do. We are called to proclaim the excellencies of God and his son, Jesus Christ, and to serve as his representatives. That is what we are called to do. And do we do that in our services, in our Bible studies, in our classes? I hope so. In other words, the objective is not services. The objective is transforming into more and more the image of his son. And we use this tool here of gathering together to study in order to or achieve that objective. In 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 8 and 9, Paul says there, therefore do not be ashamed of the testimony of our Lord or of me, of his prisoner, but join with me in suffering for the gospel according to the power of God, who has saved us and called us with a holy calling, not according to our works, in other words, not because we're such good people, but according to his own purpose and grace, which was granted to us in Christ Jesus from all eternity. It's a powerful passage. God did not call us because of what we did. He called us because of what his son did. That made the calling possible and real and profitable for all parties involved. And we are to honor that calling by responding rightfully to the call, to the invitation. Again, we are expected to offer testimony of the Lord because that's what disciples do. Notice also in this passage that we are to suffer for the gospel. And I know that we sometimes feel like we're suffering when we have to hear a sermon, right? I've been on the other side. I know what that's like. Or a sermon series, for that matter. But Paul realized that being called into discipleship with Christ took priority over everything else and cost more than anything else. It was an all-or-nothing venture. You can't half be called, and you can't half commit. It's all-or-nothing. In John chapter 10, verse 27, Jesus says, "My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me." Remember what we said last night in the lesson, where Jesus says in Luke 6:46, "Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and don't do what I say?" In the same context here, we could say Jesus might be saying it in this way. "Why do you call me your shepherd when you don't follow me?" If indeed that's the case. In Revelation chapter 14, there's a similar expression there, or a similar sentiment being expressed there. "These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes, these who have been purchased by his blood. They have been purchased from among men as first fruits to God and to the Lamb." So there's this idea of being purchased and being called and being invited, and then on our part, our response to that is to follow and to obey and to conform. And those who belong to Christ will follow him. Those who will not follow Christ are not his disciples. They are not his sheep, and they are not identified with him at all. I didn't say that. Jesus is saying that. God is saying that. Here's the thing. Just because people become Christians doesn't mean they automatically understand discipleship or that they understand the nature of being called or the calling itself. Likewise, just because people go to church doesn't automatically make them disciples. Church going doesn't make you a disciple of Christ any more than going to a science exhibit makes you a scientist, or going to an art exhibit makes you an artist or even an expert on art. You can't just go to something and then kind of through osmosis or association, just suddenly become, you know, the expert or the follower of whatever it is that you're going to. It just doesn't work like that in any other context. In a negative sense, Jesus made several profound statements of what a disciple is not. And we're going to look at that first, just to get the negative stuff out of the way. And again, I don't want you to think that, oh, we're just pounding on the negative. No, Jesus said these words, and they're worthy of our attention. In other words, you cannot be my disciple if, and then he gives us the rest of that. So let's turn over there to Luke chapter 9, verse 62, that I alluded to earlier. Luke chapter 9 and verse 62, where he had said to a man, "I will follow me," and another had said, "I will follow you, Lord, but first permit me to say goodbye to those at home." And Jesus said to him, "No one after putting his hand to the plow and looking back is fit for the kingdom of God," which is another way of saying, you cannot be my disciple if that's the attitude you're going to have. And I don't know that we fully understand what he's talking about here. It took me a long time, if indeed I've mastered it yet, it took me a long time to finally realize what he was actually saying here. To look back brings to mind Lot's wife. Remember Lot's wife? As Lot and his wife were fleeing from the pelting of hellfire, in the sense of fire and brimstone coming down on those cities of Sodom and Gomorrah and the other cities of the valley there, and they were told to go away and to not look back, and she looked back and turned into a pillar of salt there in Genesis 19. The reason she turned to salt was because she was being punished, because she expressed, in essence, where her heart really was. It wasn't in front where salvation was, where she was told to go. It was behind her and what she left behind. I want you to think about that. Jesus has told us, by the way, in Luke 17:32, remember Lot's wife. In other words, don't look back. And I think that's hard for us. I really do. I think that is a struggle for us. One who professes his allegiance to Christ is not supposed to look back with fondness or regret for what was left behind. Otherwise, he is not fit. He does not conform to discipleship. I realize that this is a process of understanding this, so it's not like a one-time thing, like you look back and, oh, it's over. No hope is, to be sought again. It's not like that. But at the same time, the instruction is very clear. We are supposed to be facing forward. And our objective is toward Christ and toward heaven and toward a right relationship with God. And if we're choosing anything else other than that, and especially looking back to with fondness or regret about what we left behind, and then we render ourselves unfit. The Hebrew epistle to the Hebrews has strong words for the Jewish Christians who were looking back to the law of Moses. And in essence, the writer says there, you bring upon yourself a curse if you do that. If you abandon this calling that you agreed to, that you committed to, and look back to something less than that, anything is less than that, then you bring upon yourself a curse. In Luke chapter 14, verse 26, if you turn with me there a few pages forward, Luke chapter 14, verse 26, you can tell Jesus is kind of really clamping down, I suppose, on the people's perception of him as a Messiah that's going to deliver them. It's all going to be carefree and good. And he starts talking some pretty strong language because large crowds are going with him. And he turns to them and says, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. This is imperative language. In other words, it is binding, non-negotiable, non-bargaining language. It's not like, well, I don't think he should be my disciple, or, it'd be better if he didn't do that. He's simply saying, in the very absolute sense, it cannot be this way. And I am not sure that we understand. And when I say we, I mean myself too. Not like you guys can't understand, but I think we people struggle with what he is saying here. What he's talking about, though, is an allegiance of the heart. In order to become a disciple of Christ, we are supposed to commit to him above all other people, no matter how near or dear to us they are. And I mentioned something about that last night. Our commitment to Christ means relinquishing all other allegiances. Marriage, family, friends, peers, community, nation, culture, ethnicity. All of that comes underneath your commitment to Christ. So what it doesn't mean is that when you commit to Christ, you divorce your wife and you cut yourself off from your family and go and live in a cave. That's not what that means. What it does mean, however, is that you commit to Christ above your spouse, above your adoration for your children, above your allegiance to your parents, above your devotion to your job or your boss, above any friendship in this world. That's what that means. Do you struggle with that? I do too. But is that what he's saying? That's what he's saying. That's exactly what he's saying. So it doesn't mean that all ties are literally dissolved. What it means is that what ties us or binds us or unites us with Christ must remain unbreakable, and all other ties, if need be, are expendable. That's what it means. There's one tie in your life that cannot be broken, and that is your tie to Christ. Every other tie in your life, if necessary, is expendable. Let that sink in for a while and dwell on that, because that's a lot to take in, isn't it? And imagine you're one of those people in the crowd just thinking, following Jesus, and thinking, here's our Messiah. He's going to lead us to victory. He's going to throw off Rome, and we're going to be an independent nation once again, a glory like we had under David and Solomon. It's great. And then he turns to you and says, if you don't hate your father and mother and so on more than me, you're not able to be my disciple. And you're going, what? I mean, just think about the response that he must have gotten, the gaping look, the guppy eyes, and all that. Just think about the kind of response that he must have gotten. And imagine a few people went, well, if that's the way he's going to be about it, I'm going home. And that's in essence what Jesus wanted to do, not to force people to go home, but to draw a line between those who are truly going to follow him and those who simply will not do that. Family is important, to be sure. But discipleship to the master must be more important than family. Church members who are just church members will put the devotion to loved ones on par with Christ or above him. Disciples must never do this because Christ is more important, more sacred, more worthy of your devotion than your husband or your wife or your children or your parents or your grandparents or your aunts or your uncles, your cousins, or anyone else. In fact, on a side note, the best advice I can give to someone who is seeking someone to be a marriage partner for life is find someone who loves the Lord more than they will ever love you. That is the best person to find. Someone who has their priorities exactly where they should be. In Luke chapter 14, verse 27, he says, "Whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple." Once again, that binding, non-negotiable, unilateral statement there. It's this way or nothing. It cannot be otherwise. This is really not talking about an allegiance of the heart as much as it is talking about sacrificial service. In order to become a disciple of Christ, one must accept all the risks, all the responsibilities, all the obligations, and all the expectations associated with that commitment. This is where I believe truly that we break down in our understanding, because we surrender to Christ sometimes too quickly. I'm not saying that we shouldn't surrender to Christ. I'm saying sometimes we don't count the cost. We don't realize that there is a cross involved in that surrender, or we don't understand what the cross is. Cross-bearing alludes directly to walking to one's death. Think about Jesus when he carried his cross. What was he doing when he carried it? He was walking to his death. And that's what anyone did when they carried their cross back in Jesus' day. You're not carrying your cross just because you're moving your cross from one side of the room to the other, you know, for an aesthetic, pleasing look. I mean, you're carrying your cross when you're going to your death. And what Jesus is saying, in essence, and he says in Luke 9:23, actually, he says, if you don't take up your cross daily, what he's saying is every day you make a decision to carry your cross to the death if necessary, if that's what it takes. And we don't talk in that kind of language. We kind of soften the tone because we don't want to scare people and thinking that they'll actually have to die for what they believe in. So we kind of soften it down and we kind of, you know, dilute it a little bit. We make it sound a little bit more pleasing, more palatable. But you understand what Jesus is saying, and he's not mincing words here. It's very clear. And in our case, we have indeed died to the world, and we've died to those who stand in our way, and we've died to deeds of the flesh, and we've died to our own self-righteousness. We died to those things, ideally, when we were buried in the waters of baptism. At the point in time, at the event in our life when we said, I am no longer going to be living for myself like I used to. From this point forward, I'm going to live for Christ. Maybe you didn't understand all that at the time, and I didn't either. But now that we do, we can't go back. We can't claim ignorance. You know too much to claim ignorance. You will not see church members who are merely church members do this sort of thing. Religion cannot do this for you. This is personal, and difficult and radical, and I'll talk about that a little more in an upcoming lesson. In Luke chapter 14, verse 33, he says, "So then none of you can be my disciple who does not give up all his own possessions." Not literally, of course. We don't even see that being practiced among the New Testament Christians, them all just absolving themselves of all their possessions. But we do see when the time came necessary for them to give away whatever they had to give away in order for God's work to be done. We do see that. So it's not literally, but it is realistically. In other words, while we do not literally give up everything, we must have the attitude, nonetheless, of giving up everything. Every possession is expendable. Just as we said earlier, every relationship is expendable except the one we have with Christ. Now every possession is expendable except for whatever riches we have in Christ, which are not tangible, but are spiritual in nature. So ask yourself, if God required of you this instant to give up everything, your home, your heirlooms, your possessions, your vehicles, your furniture, your savings, would you do it? I'm not asking for hands here, okay? That's not my point. But ask yourself in your heart, would you do it? And if you find yourself hesitating with that, then your understanding the serious nature of discipleship. It is not for sissies. It is not for wannabes. It is not for people who are kind of laissez-faire, I'm not really committed, I just want to stay aloof and, you know, dabble in that a little bit. You know, people that want to dip their toe in the pool and call it swimming, it's not for those people. It's a serious thing. The church member will not give up everything, but disciples are asked to give up everything, and they will give up everything in their heart. A relative of mine was a Navy SEAL. I guess he would say he still is, but he was an active Navy SEAL in the Vietnam War. He was telling me about some of the training that you have to go through in order to become a SEAL. I could not believe it. I did not know how difficult this really was. One of the things they have to do is they have to tread water while holding weights. And until they are so fatigued that they sink, and in the technical sense, they drown. And then they are pulled out of the water immediately and resuscitated. The reason they go through that is because the instructors are trying to break down their fear of dying and their fear of drowning. Because once you've done it, then there's no longer fear of it. What we fear is really the unknown. We fear things, not necessarily that we have experienced, but things that look scary and that we don't want to experience. And so what they do then is they condition these soldiers into, you know, a state of mind in where they've crossed that boundary, they've crossed over that threshold, and now they don't have to be held back by that anymore, and they can go forward with their mission. It's pretty amazing. I have a real fear of drowning, by the way. Not that I've ever done it, but I'm like a lot of people. It just looks really scary and horrible, and I just don't want to have to anything to do with that. But at the same time, I want you to see a connection here to what we're talking about. Once a disciple releases every possession in his heart, in his mind, once in his attitude, he releases everything to God, those things no longer stand in the way of his service. Once he lets go of everything in this world, his wife, his husband or her husband, his children, his relatives, his possessions, everything, and he stands before God with just himself. Once he gets to that point, then that thing, that idea of losing those things is no longer impeding his discipleship. He can go forward. That's where we need to go. You say, well, that's scary stuff. I agree. It is. It's like drowning. It's like cutting off your right hand or gouging out your right eye in order to save the body. But that's what it takes. That's what real disciples do. In a real sense, we have already lost everything. And we made that commitment when we were baptized. Maybe, I was thinking just somewhat humorously anyway, when we baptize people, we should just hold them underwater until they drown and then just resuscitate them, right? Then we get over that process. There's a kernel of truth to what I'm saying there, okay? Matthew chapter 16, verse 25, Jesus says, "For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake will find it." And that's really what we're talking about, losing your life for his sake in order to find your life. Do you realize why so many people are not truly disciples but are just church members? It's because they keep trying to save their own life. And they are afraid of losing their life. They're afraid of losing what they have. They're afraid of losing their identity. They're afraid of losing their friends. They're afraid of losing their family. They're afraid of losing their status. They're afraid of losing their whatever it might be, their 401k for whatever reason. They're afraid of losing something, and that's why they won't fully commit. It's like, you know, you're holding everything here, and Jesus is saying, come follow me. And it's like, yeah, but I got all this stuff. And it's like the rich man who was pondering, you know, I've got all this property, and I'm wealthy, and he's asking me to leave all that behind. And you could see the difficulty there. And that's what we're talking about. It is a difficult proposition. And that's why Jesus says, before you commit, make sure you count the cost and understand what it is that I'm asking of you. And that's why I turn to the crowds in that manner. If you choose to save your own life, which people often measure, by the way, by their possessions, then you forfeit discipleship because you can't do them both. You are either all in or you're not in at all. As far as God's concerned, that's where we're at. We're either all in, or we're either not yet in at all, or we're thinking about it, but still not yet in, right? Only those who have given up everything can truly be his disciples. That is the language of Luke 14 there and Matthew 16, as we just said. Now, we've looked at that in a negative sense. Well, what does it mean to not be a disciple? Let's look at this now in a positive sense, and Jesus has some profound statements about that, about positively what it means to be a disciple. Well, in Matthew chapter 5, verse 13 through 16, he talks about disciples being salt of the earth and light of the world. In other words, an illuminating and preserving quality to disciples. We're not just practicing religion. We're sharing a life-giving, life-saving message. Something very positive about that. In fact, I'll go so far as to say, in this context, no one else in the world is doing that except for Christians. That's a unique vocation as well. In Matthew chapter 5, verse 10 through 12, he talks about, blessed are you when you're persecuted, and there's two qualifiers for that, for the sake of righteousness and for my name's sake, which are not two different things, but really one and the same. The disciple is one who is willing to suffer for what and who he believes in. In other words, he believes to his own hurt. He believes even when it really works against him, as far as this life is concerned. Now, I want to clarify here, not all suffering and all persecution is commendable. I think there's a lot of idiots out there, honestly, who suffer persecution because they believe in really silly things. Things that are not worth believing in, but they believe in them anyway, and people persecute them for that, and they get what they deserve. So we're not saying that just because you're suffering or just because you're being persecuted that God's patting you on the back and saying, wow, what a servant of mine. Not necessarily at all. Only when you do suffer for righteousness and his namesake, that is what brings commendation from God. 1 Peter 3:17 says, for it is better if God should will it so that you suffer for doing what is right rather than doing what is wrong. This disciple who does that has to have conviction and moral excellence. A conviction we can define as a belief that is so strong that it demands action. It compels obedience. It is not something that you ponder over and go, I think I have conviction. No, it's something that you believe so strongly that it forces you into action. It forces a behavior. And a moral excellence in the classical Greek literally meant a courage to do what is right because it is right. It actually meant manliness, or a courage in that sense. But the courage to do what is right regardless of the consequences. And not sitting there and thinking, well, where's this going to take me? I wonder what negative effects I'm going to have. What do my friends think about me? What are my parents going to say? What are the church members going to say if I do this or that? It doesn't take any of that into consideration. It says, this is the right thing to do and I'm going to do it. That is moral excellence. And it's that kind of character that is necessary in order to suffer in this respect here. In Matthew 25, verse 34 through 40, we see an illustration of disciples who are taking care of their own in honor of the Master. By tending to the needs of fellow believers, we show deep respect for the Master himself. It is as if we are serving Christ himself, because he even says, if you've done it to these, then it's like you've done it to me. And so when we do serve others, we should see the image of Christ in our service to that person. That's how we should be. That's how we should think. That's what disciples do. They don't serve because some preacher prodded them and says, you've got to go out there and serve. You know, okay, you know, that's not like that. And we're not doing it out of guilt. We're not doing it out of fear. We're not doing it for any other ulterior motive. We're doing it because it's the right thing to do. Because Jesus asked us to do it. And we want to serve the Master. Mark chapter 10, verse 29 through 30. Jesus says, whoever leaves home, family, or farm behind for my sake, he says, will receive 100 times as much in this life as well as eternity with God. Eternal life with God. In this life, you're going to receive much. And you might look at that and go, yeah, but I don't understand. I'm giving up so much, and then I'm receiving. Don't seem to work. The math doesn't work here. There's a difference between a waste and a sacrifice. Let's look at it in this respect. A waste is a complete loss with zero return. A sacrifice is a voluntary or purposeful loss with deliberate intent of gaining something better than what was lost. If you're familiar with a game of chess, which I love to play, so it comes natural that I would think of this. If you're going to put your queen out there to get captured because you're just not paying attention, or because you made a move that really was careless and thoughtless and, you know, you just don't understand the game and it gets captured, that's a waste. But if you put your queen out there in order to draw the attention of your opponent to capturing that queen so that you can get at his king, that's a sacrifice. Because you gave up something very valuable and very important. The queen is the most valuable piece on the board, except for the king, of course. But you give up the queen in order to win the game. That's what sacrifice is all about. You give up something important, yes, in order to win something even more important as your objective. In Luke chapter 10, verse 38 through 42, we have the account there of Mary and Martha. Jesus at the home of Mary and Martha there, and Martha's all busy doing whatever, preparations for the meal, and Mary is sitting at the feet of Jesus listening to his words, and Jesus called that the good part. Not that preparing meals is bad, that's not the lesson there, but if the master is sitting in your house and you're busy washing dishes or fixing food or something like that, what you really should be doing is sitting at the feet of the master. That's the lesson. And that's the good part. And that's what he expects of the disciples. To sit at the master's feet means to absorb and internalize and immerse yourself in his teaching. That's what it means. It doesn't mean just read the word. It means dwell on the word and take that word and put it into your heart. We sometimes say, you know, Lord, in our prayers, or, you know, help us to apply your word to our lives. No, help you to apply your life to his word. That's what you should be doing. Let this word be your life and the instructions and the guidance that you need. Sit at the feet of the master. In Luke chapter 12 and verse 37 through 38 there, it says, "Blessed are those slaves whom the master will find on the alert when he comes. Truly I say to you that he will gird himself to serve, and they have come to recline at the table. He will come up and wait on them. Whether he comes in the second watch or even in the third and finds them so, blessed are those slaves." Well, the disciples are slaves. We are slaves of righteousness. We are slaves of the master. We are slaves of the kingdom of God. And that's not a bad thing. That's what we want to be. That's a good place to be. Jesus' point here is that his disciples are those who are always vigilant, always prepared, always ready for the master's return. They do not procrastinate. They are not derelict in their duties. They do not live with carelessness or indifference. They're not all prepared one day and then the next day it's all falling to pieces. Totally unprepared. Like you see some Christians sometimes, "Today I'm spiritual," and then the next day it's like, "Oh, I'm down the dumps. My spirit life is a mess." Christ did not call us to be churchgoers. He did not call us to be church members. He did not call us to perform church services. He did not call us to be in a church directory. I'm not saying these things are wrong. I'm saying that's not what he called us for. Christ called us through his gospel to be his dedicated, exclusive, vocal followers. Not just vocal when in the company of friends and fellow believers like we are right now. This is easy. But vocal, even when we're in the midst of our known enemies and unbelievers, that's hard, but it's necessary. Modern representations of discipleship pale in comparison to what Christ describes in his Gospels. Many of our brethren, in fact, have sold out, I believe, and have bought into this scaled-down, diluted, diminished version of discipleship, which corresponds to the lazy, preoccupied, entertainment-seeking expectations of a spiritually lukewarm religious world. In other words, that's what we see all around us in the world today in what we call religion, and especially Christian religion. As we see people really seeking the path of least resistance, as I mentioned last night, instead of the path of righteousness. And what I'm saying here tonight is that you can't afford to do that, and that we should commit never to do that. Many brethren are comfortable practicing religion, but they do not understand vocation, the vocation to which they were called. I know what this sounds like, probably. It probably sounds radical, doesn't it? It probably sounds revolutionary and even militant, like the Christian version of a jihad or something like that, you know. It probably does have that ring to it there. But the truth is that discipleship is radical and it is revolutionary because that's the way that Jesus himself depicted it. It's not something you go, yeah, I think I'll be a disciple today or for the rest of my life. It's not something you just kind of stumble into or enter into lightly. It's far more than that, far more involved than that. In a sense, it is militant because we are at war. Christ is our leader. He is our captain. And we cannot expect to be putting on the full armor of God in order to play church or in order to practice religion or to sit on pews. The reason you suit up with the full armor of God, ideally, is because you are preparing to go into battle. Not just sing songs about going into battle, but actually going into battle. Sometimes it seems that Christians manifest split personalities. On one hand, they talk like aggressive soldiers, strength and honor, you know, the Roman allegiance thing. I saw Gladiator, I know what it's like. And so the whole idea here is, you know, there's this, we're all standing together and we're, you know, rattling our sabers and everything else. And on the other hand, we act like passive civilians who are oblivious to the fact that there's a war going on. And James in 3 verse 10 says, my brethren, these things ought not to be in this way. They ought not to be that way at all. When you became a Christian, you took up a new career that was far more important than your secular job. You responded to a calling that's far more sacred than any other calling. You accepted as responsibility far more demanding than all other responsibilities. In Ephesians chapter 4, verse 1, Paul says, I, the prisoner of the Lord, implore you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling of which you've been called. Paul was not just making small talk here. He's sitting in prison as he wrote those words, for his faith, and encouraging us to imitate his conviction and his moral excellence to the point of our own imprisonment, if that's what it takes. And it may take that in future days, I don't know. So what about you? Are you living in a manner worthy of the calling? Do you understand what your calling is all about? Do you understand what's involved now when Jesus called you and you said, yes, I'll go? Or maybe you haven't made that decision and now you know better of the cost of discipleship. And I ask you, I know that I've given you a lot to think about, and I don't apologize that, but I do ask you to dwell upon that. If you've not yet responded to the call of the gospel, there remains an opportunity, even still. But at the same time, you don't have all the time in the world. Understand that as well. You don't have all the time in the world. I hope this lesson has been encouraging, inspiring, motivating, and whatever else is good. Take it to heart. And if you need to respond, well, we do have a song. Roy's going to lead us in a song. If you need to come forward this evening, then do so while we stand and sing the song Roy selected for us.